Listener Production.
You are listening to episode 28 of the Howie Games Artist Series Part B featuring Mark Seymour. Remember, check out Mark's new album, The Boxer, dropping April 19, and you can check him out live with The Undertow. Head to markseymour.com.au. On we go. So you're a young man. Where does your performing musical journey start in a band, per se?
The first band I ever, rock and roll band I ever played in was... In a house in Air Street, Lower Templestowe.
It's not exactly rock and roll.
In a family den of this house, and it was a guy named Kieran who played the bass, and we used to do endless versions of Jumping Jack Flash. And no one sang. Oh, well, I actually did sing, but we didn't have microphones.
Right.
And we just played those riffs, Rolling Stones riffs, over and over.
Did the band
again.
Have
now,
a name?
Now, he's probably, he may well hear this.
Kieran will be, did it have a name, the band, or it didn't get to that point?
No, it didn't have a name.
Okay.
No.
So what's the first?
And then the next cover band, I was in a cover band with John Archer and Doug Faulkner and Rob Miles, who were all at, well, Doug wasn't, but John and Rob were at college at uni.
And what type of stuff were you playing?
This really weird, eclectic mix of sort of 50s and 60s pop songs.
And were you the front man? Were you singing at this stage?
I did sing one song.
Okay, what was the song?
Twist and Shout by the Beatles.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I did have a moment, and when I first stepped up to sing that, I'd just been given the song. I think John Archer told me, that's your song, you sing that. Everyone sang. And I said, oh, okay, I'll do that. Maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I just said, I want to do that, I can't remember. But I did that. And it was in high and D, and I could scream it. And as soon as I did that, I thought, oh, shit, that sounds all right. You know, it sounds kind of cool, you know.
So this was your beginning of being the lead
singer?
Yeah,
the seed was sown in that moment. Yeah, I thought, that's what I want to do.
Well, and what are you doing to, I'm not saying you weren't getting paid big bucks at these stages with the bands. But how are you supporting yourself, Mark? Did you ever have a profession?
That was still at uni. I was still a student.
What were you studying?
Teaching.
So you followed on from your mum and dad?
Yeah, that's where I was going.
So did you ever teach?
Yeah.
How long for?
Not long.
Okay, give me a time frame, a couple of years or a couple of weeks?
No, well, I actually, you know, it was probably a semester. I got posted to Braybrook Secondary College.
And what were you teaching?
Social studies, English, a little bit of maths.
You were Mr. Seymour, the teacher?
Pretty much, yeah.
Did you have a couple of pencils in the front pocket and a short sleeve shirt or not?
Yeah, no, I had henna'd hair.
You had what?
Henna. My hair was dyed red. And kids used to say that they were hilarious kids. I mean, now I would probably have, I'd handle it a lot better than I did in those days, but I was pretty raw.
Right.
And I took myself very seriously.
Right.
But the kids used to think that, there'd be kids listening to this now who would have been.
Of course they will.
Used to sort of make my sex computer games noises every time I walked on the corridor, you know, between classes, because I thought I looked like him. You
know? So did the teaching career not go
for
long?
Quite funny.
Did the teaching career not go for long because you realised it wasn't you, or because rock and roll swept you up in its bosom and took you away?
To be honest, very pragmatic decision. I made the decision that if I was going to be serious about teaching, I had to basically abandon, either throw myself into it 100% and forget about music,
yep,
or get into music at that point in my life, because I would end up becoming, the money would be there, I'd be a salaried teacher, and my life would evolve around the income. And that's pretty much what happens in your early professional life in whatever area you go into. And I thought, well, I'm either going to do that, and that means I've got to get rid of this. I thought, no, I can't get rid of that. I couldn't do both. So the idea of having a profession and doing something on the side, there was no way I was going to do that. So I just went, righty, I got out of teaching.
So then you're fully committed to music?
Yeah, 100%.
So how tough are the early years as a non-teaching musician trying to support himself playing in cover bands or actual bands at this stage?
I was pretty quick. I went back to see then the boys that I'd been playing with,
yep,
John Archer and Doug Faulkner and Rob Miles,
yep.
We went on, I said I want to do original band, and we actually formed a group called the Jetsons with Margot O'Neill on lead vocals, and she was
the Jetsons.
Margot O'Neill. She was a journo. She ended up in Canberra. And I did that for a while, and then I said, I don't want to do this. It's not cool enough. And went back to them and said, I want to do another band. And I'd met Greg Pirano by then. He was a percussionist. And all of that while I was actually in working for the tax office.
Hang on, there's a story, like accounts receivable, or what were we doing at the tax office?
Sales tax.
Sounds dull.
It was terrible.
Hello to everyone out there in the tax department that works on sales tax, but it doesn't sound like my cup of tea.
Well, we don't have sales tax now. We have GST.
Right.
Know? But in those days, you had to vet. People would have to, it was this laborious system of goods and services where if you're in a business, you would have to submit a return,
right.
Monthly return.
Yep.
Every month,
yep.
And people would get them wrong. Like there's handwritten, you'd fill out a form and send it in an envelope.
Yeah.
And you would have to, I'd sometimes be in the post room and have to open the envelopes and see whether the forms were correctly filled in. And if they were, then they'd put in that tray. And if they weren't, I'd have to go and fill another form out.
What year is this?
Everything's written. It's pre-digital, you know.
So
this would be 1980, hang on. 1980.
Amuse me. What's Mark Seymour wearing to work in the tax office?
Oh, just a. It was not that.
Was
rigorous.
It short sleeve and tie?
Oh yeah. no shirt, like a collared shirt.
Okay.
Sports coat.
Right.
Yeah, and chinos.
I spoke about my dad before. I remember him in the. I still remind him the short sleeve and the tie.
Yeah.
Not a good look.
Yeah. I could have gotten to that. I don't think I was there. I mean, I think, I don't know how long I worked there.
So okay.
The thing is, it was really quick, the whole transformation.
So did this become Hunters and Collectors, this crew that you're talking about now?
Pretty much.
So yeah. Where's the name come from?
Well, Greg Pirano, who was in the earliest incarnation of the group, he came up with the name.
What was its relevance?
It's the name of a song by this German experimental kind of jazz, sort of acid funk group called Can, who were quite big in Europe.
Right.
And they had these long, drawn-out funk songs that were really industrial and very dark. And there was music coming out of Germany at that time that was really, for want of a better word, inspired by the Cold War. So it was a very dark sound. And they were signed to Virgin as well. And he played me this music, and I really liked the idea of putting together a group that played funk, was kind of industrial funk, was very heavy.
But where does that tie into the name?
Well, they had a song called Hunters and Collectors.
So Tommy, our wonderful producer, he'll try and find that. And
I think
this could test Tommy, but we'll whack a bit of it in now if we can find it. So
it says Hunters and Collectors never see the light. Hunters and collectors all come out at night.
And these are German dudes singing this.
Yeah, like that. Hunters and collectors all come out at night. Hunters and collectors
never see the light. What's the first song that Hunters and Collectors have that is played on the radio? And this is my favourite question to all the artists. Some remember, some don't. Can you remember the first time you heard one of your songs on the wireless?
Well, it was Talking to a Stranger.
Right.
And that was the first album, and it was really...
What was the name of the first album?
It was self-titled, Hunters and Collectors.
Hunters and Collectors, yep.
Yeah. But the song was like a standout. It was, even amongst the catalogue at that time, it was kind of like a Cool and the Gang... Industrial bass, John Archer smashing the bass because he always hit the bass really hard. Industrial percussion, like we had metal objects, but this really solid dance groove. So it kind of had this swagger to it and very melodic. So it was all these pop elements, but in a landscape that was quite heavy and powerful, very powerful song. But it was really well constructed. That was a huge breakthrough, you know, and we had a very interesting video from Richard Lewinstein and... he's lived in Melbourne boy.
Yep.
He made this really quite compelling video. And it was all sort of, you know, the Cold War was just massive. And, you know, it was a very dark chapter in our history, I suppose, in world history. And it kind of alluded to this whole idea of, you know, the end of the world. And I remember he went down. The clip was really good.
I'll have to have a look at it.
Yeah. And it really made a mark very quickly.
And so, and did you hear that on the radio first?
Well, I think you still hear it. I like Triple M.
Yeah, of course you do. Yeah,
I think Eon might have played it. Like it was actually
Triple M would still play "Talk to a Stranger." But yeah, do you recall the moment when you heard it for the first time or not on the radio?
I think I heard it on Triple R.
Okay,
but look, again, it got picked up all over the place. There was a lot of these sort of big community stations all over the country as well. It got all this attention. But it was pretty radical, you know, for the kind of music that Australian audiences were absorbing, and we kind of thought, oh, well, we need to go overseas. Now, in retrospect, now, as I said earlier, that we would make these decisions, which in all innocence, you know, we thought that was the right thing to do.
Go on tour.
Well, we thought we'd have better shot in Europe, you know, because we just didn't think that Australians would necessarily respond to what we were doing, even though we sort of didn't really give it a chance. Like, so we were getting, we'd do Melbourne, Sydney, we'd go up and down the Hume Highway for a while, and you do sort of two or three shows in each in Sydney, and then gradually that extended to Brisbane. But we left Australia probably too soon, I think.
And how did that go?
Well, we went to England. It was an absolute disaster.
Oh, you discussed that.
It was a complete disaster.
So in the timeline of Hunters and Collectors, how long and how many albums till you are household name, selling out, sweaty, pumping crowds, genuine rock stars?
Well, I remember Lee Simon, who's a very good friend of mine.
Right, he was my first boss here at Triple M Football.
Rightio.
He put me on the boundary for the first time.
Rightio. Oh, actually, that's excellent.
He ran Triple M Football for 15 or 20 years.
I've known Lee for years, right? And he said to me a while ago, I've told this story, and he said, really, you didn't get solid rotation? We got solid rotation in 1989.
89?
Yeah. I might have been 1990, 89, 90, with When the River Runs Dry.
How many years you been at it at this stage with Hunters?
Well, that's 9 years.
Right. The old overnight success that wasn't an overnight.
Well, yeah. Well, see, this the thing is, we had a very, you know, it looked great at the start. You know, it looked really like, oh, I think this is going to go, you know. And then it kind of just went into this sort of, we went into the doldrums. And we came back to Australia from England and basically regrouped and changed the whole character of the music. And I started writing straight songs, like just like Throw Your Arms Around Me was written quite in 1984.
So that was written in 1984?
Yeah.
But surely that was an enormous hit.
No.
But now here's a story. Well, because obviously Hunters and Collectors, first song people are going to say typically is Throw Your Arms Around Me, which is just an amazingly beautiful song and everyone would have their own memories of it of my generation. So that didn't just go straight to number one.
No, well, no songs we released as singles did that. What they do is they'd get a lot of support on tour, and then radio would respond to that because the song would be researching really well, and then it would get airplay.
So what happened when
it would be a sort of a gradual process of exposure, you know, radio reacting to it because people really like this. They play it once or twice, but the versions of Throw Your Arms Around We kept putting it out. Eventually, it wasn't until 1990 that we actually put out a version that sounded sufficiently radio friendly to get reasonable airplay. But so, by then we'd already recorded it like four times.
So tell me about the, you wrote the song.
Yeah.
Tell me about the genesis of that song.
The record company and Michael, our manager, he came to me alone and said, if you guys need to make a commercial record, if you don't make a commercial record, there's got some chance of reaching a wider audience, then your careers are going to end because you just can't keep going and it's costing you too much money to tour. And he just basically told me the awful truth. And I actually thought at that time, so this is around 1984, that the idea of writing commercial songs really appealed to me because it just would mean three chords and a prayer. like just keeping things very simple, simple messaging, whatever. And I took the, I really took that under my, took the, you know, bit into that hard. And I had, I remember having a meeting with the drummer, Douglas Faulkner, and I think Robert Miles was there at the Standard in Fitzroy. We met there and I said, look, this is what I've been told, you know. And they went, oh, yeah, right, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, fair enough, yeah, whatever. And we recorded Three Arms Around Me. There were a couple of other, on a little EP, but we did it. We, for some reason, the band decided, oh, we won't go fully commercial. We'll do it on VHS tape and we'll do it direct to stereo two-track. Why? I have no idea. But it was kind of, we felt comfortable with that rather than going into a multi-track suite and actually really throwing everything at it.
Was it about someone in particular, a relationship, a friendship?
Yes.
Or can you talk about that or not? You don't,
yeah,
no,
yeah,
you don't want to.
Yeah, I was seeing a girl named May.
Right.
Who I used to, I'd known from school. I'd known her from primary school. The first time I met her was at Beaufort Primary School when we were in grade five. And then I met her again at Melbourne Uni and I fell in love with her and wrote the song about her.
Pretty much.
That's the story.
But what a...
And I was seeing her around that time and I just thought, and I was also listening to Van Morrison, a lot of Van Morrison, and particularly Astral Weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a real interest. I had an interest in that romantic poetry. And I thought, I want to write a song that's like that.
We may never meet again. So shed your skin and let's get started. You will throw your arms around me.
Is May still with us?
Yeah.
Have you ever had the discussion with her what it is like to have a global worldwide hit sung about her?
No, I've never really asked her that
question. Ask her the question.
Yeah, yeah, maybe
I'll. Ask her the question.
Maybe I should. Yeah, I ran into her about a year ago, actually.
Like, it's a phenomenal thing to have a song written about you, but a song that so many people in this country and worldwide would connect to.
Yeah, I wouldn't assume that she would necessarily relate to it. But the thing about writing songs is someone can be an inspiration or a conversation can be a trigger, but then your imagination takes you somewhere else.
You're
dealing with a form, you know, and you've kind of got to make that work as a communication tool and put words in that are going to engage with an audience. And so there's a lot of guesswork. So someone might come back to that. You say that you were the inspiration for the song and go, really?
But still, without May.
That's meant to be about me.
But still, without May, that song may not exist.
Well, the whole experience, correct.
Yeah. So again, back to the question we were talking about, Lee Simon and River Runs Dry and 89. So then what is life like when you go from being a band that's slogging away to a band that is selling out wherever they go and you are the archetypical rock star and you're living that life? And how do you keep your feet on the ground, or do you not?
Well, I don't think I did. Right. I think I was.
I like that answer, Mark.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm much older now and I look back on the way I lived my life and I just don't think, I think at the time I thought I'm in control.
How did you live your life?
I drank probably too much, but I was running. But I was young, you know, I was able to drink and sleep, get intermittent sleep and still managed to perform. And you know, I don't think I sang particularly well, but the band had a really big drinking culture, you know, and it became really good at playing in pubs. And I couldn't really honestly tell you when the thing really shifted, but I know when the River Runs Dry was released, it pretty much consolidated. Because the thing about the whole Australian quota system, and you can kind of be hidden away after midnight. You can still get exposure, but you're not necessarily reaching a lot of people because, as you know, in radio, the audience shifts dramatically throughout a 24-hour cycle. So we never really knew how many people we were getting across to, but it gradually became apparent from 89, 90 that we were going out and playing in the western suburbs of Sydney and North Brisbane and big numbers, like they were packed out rooms.
And what is that like when you're on stage and people are singing your lyrics back to you?
The funny thing about, just to shift it slightly, Three Arms Around Me proved for me to be a real way of letting the pressure out, because those rooms could be threatening, you know. I think, definitely think that the, I don't know who decided what a capacity was, but some of the rooms had too many people in them.
A few extra snuck in there.
Yeah. I don't know how they worked that out. It was, there was a lot of people with skin in the game. You know, there's promoter, there's the venue owner, there's the band, obviously, management, record company. Everybody's kind of going, watching these numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger and thinking, what does it actually mean? But really, a lot of it was financial. And I just think there were risks involved in it. And I used to go into those rooms scared. I would be frightened before I went on stage.
Scared of what?
Well, I got to the point where, and this is not to in any way diss the whole thing, because again, as I said, I was young, and every gig was a learning curve, you know. But I think it got to the point where you were worried that there'd be fights. And you know, I talked to guys in bands from that era who all share that same kind of story of concern, that you would, there was always the possibility at a certain point in the, especially in the early 90s.
Alcohol, hot, sweaty, packed.
Yeah, people squeezing together. And, and you know, and then the security escalated and, you know, and security guys, the pressure these dudes are under, you know, because you never knew where it would happen. And I got to the point where that really started to wear me down, like throughout the early 90s. And it may well have been one of the nails in the coffin, really. It just got really hard, you know.
We've mentioned a couple of songs. Holy Grail, Bring It Back to Sport.
Yeah, yeah.
has become a sporting anthem.
I was in the biggest army the world has ever seen. We were marching as one on the road to the Holy Grail.
And people associate it with the football on Channel 10, which I will get to.
Yeah, yeah.
I worked on that coverage. But was it cricket that first embraced it as
Yeah, yeah. I was promoting, it was 96, and I was promoting my first solo record. And I was in Brisbane, and the girl from the label said, oh, there's an event going on out at, and she wasn't even into sport, at the cricket ground, the Brisbane cricket ground.
At the Gabba?
Oh, no, it wasn't the Gabba.
Right.
Okay. Actually, it was somewhere near Fortitude Valley. It was an old ground, but don't think it was the Gabba. And there was Queensland had won the Sheffield Shield.
Broken the drought.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So she said, they want you to go out and sing through Holy Grail. And I went, oh, yeah, really? You know, what the hell is that? You know, cricket. You know, I mean, I just thought, this is going to be so stiff.
It sounds it.
And we're in a tent in the middle of the ground, and there's all the family, friends, players, whatever, they're all there. And they were like, almost, I don't know, it was very religious.
Right.
And I just realised, shit, this is a big deal. And these guys are saying, oh, mate, we fucking love that song.
The cricketers?
Yeah. I had them in the, you know, coming up, and they were really thankful. And I thought, oh, it was lovely. It was quite lovely, you know. But that was the first time I realised that something had happened.
Yes, to the song that you hadn't written about sport.
Yeah.
To a song. So as I said, Mark, I worked on the back end of the Channel 10 football coverage.
That's
on the boundary,
right,
for the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
For 10 years that 10, and they did a great job. This was Robert Walls, Anthony Hudson, Michael Christian, Steve Silvani, Christy Malthouse. That was all the footy was on 10. And Holy Grail was the signature song. And I texted my former boss today, a gentleman by the name of Dave Barham, and I said, he was a creative fella. How did it come about? And he said, yeah, it was my idea. Now, his recollection, it's a long time ago, was meeting you in an apartment and signing a deal to use that song.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a license. It was a licensed.
Right. So you have a recollection of that?
Not specific signing.
So,
but it was a licensed deal to Channel 10, definitely.
Right. And
No. It's a deal to AFL, wasn't it? I'm not quite sure how it worked.
Probably, whoever it was, for 10 years, that song was a constant, where as soon as you heard that first two, ding, ding, it was the footy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's super cool from the outside.
Absolutely
looking
right.
In.
I mean, I would go now, but at the time, this is kind of how your mind works as an artist. I've always had this feeling that if somebody presents me with a concept about a song I've written or for its use, if I kind of have an aversion to it and I'm not sure what it means, I generally lean in because I think
you have a go. I generally have a go.
Yeah,
well, that's a fantastic attitude to say yes. Fantastic attitude, Mark. It's a key to life.
It comes with a sense of not knowing and fear. If there's a bit of fear in there, I generally take an interest, you know, because I reckon that negative dialogue is something that artists routinely fall prey to because they fear losing control. But now when I look at it, I go, the idea that a song could be that totally interpreted in a... It wouldn't be the first time it's happened either with songs.
But it would connect to... You haven't written it about football, but I can guarantee you anyone in that era of watching football, as soon as they hear the first two bars of that song, they think footy.
Yeah.
Like they think footy. As soon as they hear Holy Grail.
Yeah, well, I do it really... And it doesn't have a chorus. And it didn't... And one of the guys in Hunters and Collectors reminded me a few months ago, Barry Palmer... He was in the band at that point when we recorded the album that's got Holy Grail on it, that apparently the producer of the record, I know there were guys in the band who didn't want it on the record, but the producer of the record didn't want it on, right? He's actually going, no, he was an American guy. I don't want, it's got no chorus. Radio will not play that song. It's got no chorus. And before any of this stuff had happened, I remember thinking, there's something about the story in that song that will grab people's imagination because I'm not sure to this day whether or not when you're in a studio with other musicians and you're making records, people come into the process thinking about what they can contribute musically. They're not necessarily thinking about what the song's about. The dude who writes the song or the primary composer is thinking about that. And I don't automatically assume that because I'm preoccupied with that, everywhere else in the room's going to be. You know, I just generally take the view, if somebody needs to be told, this song's about that, that was one of those occasions and I just dug my heels in and said, no, it's got to go on the record.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Well, I am too.
More of Mark shortly. I love how much you all have been enjoying the Artist Series. I can tell from the download numbers, so thank you for everyone expanding their mind past sport. After Eric Banner, you've all been asking for more movie stars, not easy to get hold of. Thanks to the love about Jeremy Piven in the last Artist Series, we'll try and get more movie stars, although it is hard to match the great Eric Banner.
By pure luck, I was in LA and my agent said, Spielberg wants to meet you. And he said, it's secretive. No one knows what this project is. No one knows why he wants to meet you. But these are the rumors of the projects he's developing. Blah, 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 blah. So I go out to the desert, to the set of the terminal, and I meet him in his lunch break. And I'm just like, what is going on here? Tom Hanks is there in his Airstream, says a quick hello, and I'm in awe of him. And Stephen starts talking about this project. And I hopped in the car, and I was driving back. The hotel and my agent called and he was like, tell me exactly what he said. I said, I think he said, I want you to play. I'm pretty sure that's what he said. He said, you're damn right he did. You know, like I just got a phone call, blah, blah, blah. And it's just this surreal moment. It was like, oh my God.
That was Eric Banner on episode 26 of the Artist Series, which dropped back on February 15. Let's get back to Mark. It's funny, we talked about right at the start COVID. To try and keep some sanity prevailing, I tried to, no musical talent, no musical background, I tried to learn the guitar.
What, that song?
Well, I tried to learn during COVID the guitar and I'm not naturally talented at it, but I can play the guitar now.
Good.
I'm not bloody Jimi Hendrix by any stretch of the imagination, but I can get through the basic chords. I've developed bar chords recently, which is good. But that song, I can play that song. But
it's pretty simple.
Well,
it's only got three moving parts.
Well, it might be simple for you. Anyway, but then obviously you play and then you think, well, there's no point playing without trying to sing. So, and I'm a horrible singer, but that song, it starts off okay. And then when you get to the higher part, I'm completely lost.
Oh, yeah.
It's a hard song to sing. Especially when you can't sing.
I'm not sure how easy my songs are to sing, really. I Throw Your Arms Around Me is not easy to sing.
No. No, can't sing that one.
It's got an odd chorus.
Can't sing that one.
The covers I've heard of it, everyone's got an angle on that that's not like mine.
Eddie Vedder covered that, didn't he?
Yeah, and Ed Sheeran.
Ed Sheeran, yeah. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
How does that complete rabbit hole we're going down? How is it when a global artist like Ed Sheeran or Eddie Vedder starts playing your songs?
I don't get it, really. I mean, it's fantastic. Well, I mean, it's a great privilege. I mean, they're very respectable, talented.
But surely you get that they're beautiful songs that have connected with those people, so therefore they want to have a crack at them.
Put it this way, I'm pretty intrigued as to why that song has had that level of impact. It's pretty, and given its trajectory, like in the way,
well,
the way it was recorded by Hunters and Collectors, and the attitude was never clear to me what the other guys actually thought of that song, but it's definitely a standout. I mean, in retrospect, it's so different to anything else the band did.
Mm.
Like, it's so different. And in a way, I think it's actually really, if I wrote that now, it would be really different as well. There's something about that the combination of the way that chorus sounds and the way it talks about this dude who's going to meet a woman.
Mm.
And it's not, he's just very, very inside that experience. And it's very honest. And I think people really respond to that. And I didn't realize just how raw that lyric is at the time. I just was so immersed in the experience, and that's pretty rare. I mean, it's very hard to do. I'd barely do that now. I mean, occasionally there's a couple of songs on this record I reckon that come close to it, but
give me an example so we can whack some in.
There's a song called Cobblestones,
mm-hmm,
on this record, which it's a love story. That's pretty close.
Well, I'm gone.
Complete change of direction.
Sorry about that.
No. I'm going to change the direction now.
Oh, cool. Yeah, sure.
You have been open talking about this, but it's a hard thing to wade into, but I'm going to straight away. Classrooms and kitchens.
Sits by the window in a blue rubber chair. They've wiped the lips and they've tied back a hair. Come on, lay down.
Oh, yeah.
A song about your mum,
yeah,
which is close to my heart, even more so when I read about it, which I'll explain to you why at the end. But tell me about that story about your mum and the involvement you've therefore had with an organisation off the back of that.
Oh, Dementia Australia. Mm. So I decided when mum was diagnosed with Alzheimer's,
mm-hmm,
she had it a long time, like many, many years. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, people get old and they get dementia and then they die. It's not like that at all. People can have dementia for like 20 years.
Mm.
In fact, I think she had it way longer than she was diagnosed. And I think that doctors postpone diagnosis as well because it automatically triggers a whole lot of medical essentials that cost money, but also it can take the patient away from their primary caregiver, and dad was there, you know. But the thing with mum was that once I realised she had it, I realised she also taught our family, kids, got us involved in music. And at that point I went, right, I'm going to get my daughters together and we're going to form a rock little band and we're going to play at the wine bar around the corner. I had Hannah and Eva,
wow,
playing in this little wine bar down, because we used to live down on the peninsula. And I just put this little gig together. And then, you know, Eva was in year 11, I think, and Hannah was year 8 or 9, 8, year 8. You know, and they just get dressed up and we go down and play in this little wine bar and sing, I don't know, Joni Mitchell.
That experience, we'll get back to your mum, but I had the opportunity this year to play 3 games of cricket with my son, men's cricket.
Oh, yeah.
And I obviously talk about cricket for a living and have loved playing cricket over the years. Those three matches are by far and away the most fun I've ever had at cricket field.
Right.
You're playing with your son. What's the experience?
That'd be great.
Well, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we got at one stage we batted together for an extended period of time
wow.
and it was brilliant. But as a rock star who's headed up enormous gigs, what's it like then to play with your flesh and blood?
Well, it did what look, the great thing is that they got them interested in performing. And they both continue. They're both great singers, my daughters. But it also got me thinking about writing a song about mum. And
Classrooms and Kitchens.
Classrooms and Kitchens, yeah. And just trying to bookend. And that came out on the Undertow album. It was the first titled album of the band that I formed. I wanted to try and bookend. It was sort of like a bit of an arm wrestle of 3.5 minutes. How do you write a song about someone who has my first childhood memory to the last thing that I was seeing her do, which was to go in and see her in the home she was in, and how to actually tell that story in 3.5 minutes. So I thought, wow. Okay, how am I going to do this? And I was just a really big set the bar high, and it's just a very simple song, you know. But a thing about that disease, which is really weird, is it forces you to get in tight with the parent because you have to be on deck. You can't just sort of come and go as suits. I would go around there. I developed a routine around visiting her, and I probably got to see more of mum than any of my siblings, like in those last few years of her life.
Was it distressing to see her like that, or it was just comforting to spend time with her?
Oh, it's dark. I mean, anyone will tell you, you know, it's dark, you know. But it's death, you know. Mm. You're dealing with it. It's right there in the room, and it's coming, and you kind of just – it just forces you to confront a whole lot of things about your own mortality, and it changed me, you know. And I reckon I'm better for it, you know. And the thing is, if she – this is one of these great ironies about your parents dying, is that it's actually a privilege to be that close to your parents, because a lot of people doesn't happen to them.
No.
They miss it, you know. For whatever reason, you just have a different trajectory, or you're not in the country. And my brother doesn't live in Australia, and he never saw any of that. I've been around it all, you know, and with my sister. And it really did have a big effect, and probably a good one, you know.
The reason, my grandfather was a very meticulous man, got Alzheimer's, and it was, you know, I was old enough to realise that things weren't, and it's a really distressing thing to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a mate off the back of COVID, a guy called Kingy, asked me to do a podcast of his dad.
Mm.
Like these sports podcast we do, but just he said, I don't know enough about my dad's life, Mark. And we did it, and then did a couple more, and then started offering it as a service till the point I couldn't keep up. So I would have spoke to 50 or 60 people between 65 and 80 and recounted their lives with them for their family. And the amount of times their family said, I didn't know that about my mum or my dad.
Yeah.
And it was draining, but it was really rewarding. But as a result, realizing with work I didn't have time to keep up with this, sat down with a couple of other fellas and thought, right, how do we develop this into a piece of technology where people can record their stories? Now, that was 4.5 years ago, and it's an app called A Life Lived, which
is that right?
We've sort of got it working now. We haven't released it, but we've just run it through a couple of
Should you want to pitch that at Dementia Australia?
Well, we had had some chats with Dementia Australia, but we put it into a couple of retirement centres over the last 6 months to see how it would go. And I'm its greatest critic, because I know what it's like to ask someone direct questions as opposed to them listening through a phone and being recorded. And
yeah,
but it was really well taken up. But it got me, the point of the story is it got me realising how little we know about our own parents and grandparents.
Yeah.
And when they're gone, that history can never be catalogued.
Oh, well, it's totally right. And you'll never know. That's the thing as well. You kind of realise when your parents go, or very close to when you start realising there's all these things about them I don't, even if they don't have that problem, You know, there's all these things about the way your parents lived when they were in their 20s.
That you have no idea about.
And you'll never know.
No. And that's this, you know? This picks up all these things about, you know. You know, the one thing that really resonates with people, I don't know why it is, of, you know, when I was doing them personally, then we try to put it into the app, is tell me about that thing that really lit people up. Tell me about a meal, and that generation was always the mum, a meal that your mum cooked. And people would tell the stories of their lives, but when they would talk about mum's bread and butter pudding or mum's, for me, roast pork or whatever it would be, it was a massive connection point with people.
She used to do this. We would go, we lived in a little cottage on the edge of Coriel.
Yeah.
And we'd walk down towards Jeremal Creek, which is this road that is, we were right at the end of that road, the last house of the town.
Yeah.
And, you know, she would take us into the paddock next door where all the bullocks were. For some reason, I have this memory of sitting under a red gum and having egg and bacon pie.
And can you picture the pie and the taste?
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, this is what I mean.
Yeah. I know. It's like,
yeah.
I don't know why she did that.
We've got amazingly sidetracked here, and right. I can't keep you forever.
Okay.
Obviously, a massive solo career, and I hope people listen to the Boxer. How's it distributed these days? Because you would have started on records, then you went to CDs, and then so.
It's interesting.
How do you find the world
Spotify
of streaming?
It's funny how Spotify, you know, was this had this really difficult birth, and it's so controversial because it ostensibly doesn't pay, you know, royalties, and you know, Taylor Swift said some things about it. But I actually think for someone who's just a journeyman like me, it forces people. What happens is you start using it, and it takes you to these other songs, and you go, oh, that's pretty good. It actually broadens your mind. Like if when it's just radio, you're only hearing specific things that you expect to hear. Whereas Spotify, it's this incredibly fluid universe of
it directs you what you want to listen to in a way.
I generally find, maybe it's because I'm older, but I've got a pretty open mind with music now. That's all right. Yeah, shit, I don't mind that. You know, like I tend to have a pretty musical relationship with things now because I just think writing songs is hard enough in the first place, you know. Anyone can get their songs recorded. But anyway, the whole thing with promoting now is it's pretty much driven by Spotify. And there's a lot of singles, like way more than I used to put out, you know.
So how many singles would you put out from this album?
Well, there'll be there's four or five before the album's released. April 19, it's coming out. The album's coming out April 19.
April 19, we'll put this out around then. So the first single will be The Boxer.
Yeah.
Can you say what the next single will be or not?
Stars of Fitzroy.
Stars of Fitzroy. See, as a bloke that knows nothing about music, I knew which one was the banger.
Well, that was my choice too.
Right, there you
go.
Thank
you very much.
There you go. Well, congratulations
on
another amazing album. We always finish this the same way, Mark. And I've loved chatting with you. I could speak to you for another 2 hours about the life of a rock star, which fascinates me. You've had tremendous success in your chosen musical career for all those out there. And I always frame this the same way. We have a lot of kids listen to this show with their parents.
Oh, yeah.
On the way to footy training or
great
piano practice or science class.
Excuse me for any swear words I might
have said. Now, listen. Now, we had big Tex Perkins in here.
Oh, did you?
A couple of months ago.
Oh, I like Tex.
A good man, but let me say, you are an angel. You didn't use any language. A big Tex turned the place blue.
Right.
Luke Longley as well. For those that haven't listened to that episode, there's a man that can really swear as well. So you've got no problems. What advice would you give to the inquiring minds out there that want to achieve success in their field? What have you learned about life that has taken you to success?
I think it's pretty simple that whatever you choose, the right choice is the one that really personally excites you. The activity, if it's really emotionally immersive, you have a very strong attraction to the activity. And it really gets your mind working. It shouldn't be that hard to recognize the symptoms, you know. And you've got to be brave. Between the ages of 18 and 23, 24, this is where it all goes down.
Mm.
You've got to be courageous and tell your parents what you want to do. Don't hide your light. And, you know, I had that moment, and I think I made the right choice, so.
It's great advice. I like that. Tell your parents what you want to do. You don't know where life's going to take you. Somehow, Mark, I've ended up being a part owner of a brewery. I don't know how that happened. So here is the selection, the four types of Bowen Heads brewing cans for you. We've got Japanese lager, a pale, a mid, and draft.
What's the brand?
Bowen Heads Brewing Co.
So Bowen Heads.
That's where I live, down the coast.
Oh, you're down there. Okay.
Yeah,
you surf?
Yeah, I do. You would have played in the Bowen Heads Hotel. So now, actually, before I let you go, you won't remember this. Well, I don't know how well you remember venues. So the first time I saw Hunters and Collectors, which I should have started at.
Colandina.
No, because I'm not from that way. As I said, we moved around a lot. I reckon you're a million to one. And it would still not be operating. This is going to test you. Tell me, can you name the town where the venue, which is where I saw you, was called the Astrodome?
Oh, that's Traralgon.
I'm impressed. I saw you at the Astrodome in Traralgon. Yes. And I reckon I went with my dead partner, a girl by the name of Belinda Morley.
Belinda?
Good
for you. I definitely remember the Astrodome.
I had a hidden crush for Belinda Morley, but I was never I was never able to bring it out. I should have brought it out when you were singing Throw Your Arms Around Me, I would have been well and truly out of my depth.
Yeah.
Mate, enjoy the beer. Good luck with the boxer. It'll be a cracker. Thanks for joining me on the Artist Series.
Thank you.
Oh, wouldn't you love to have the talent of a professional musician? I'd give anything to be able to play the guitar and sing like that man can. Thanks to Mark, gee, he is fit and firing. What a ripper bloke he is. Do not forget Jack McCoy next Tuesday on the Artist Series and Meg Lanning on the Howie Games on Thursday. Content galore. Until then, peace and love.